Southwest Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. British Prime Minister Theresa May says an incident in which a van struck people coming out of a London mosque early today left one dead, 10 others injured, is being investigated as a potential terrorist act. This man was a witness to what happened.
Basically drove on the pavement, coming straight towards all the Muslims. And he, as he's coming to them, he hit all of them. And I think one of them died.
One of them died straight away.
One of them died. And then the rest are in a bad condition.
So can you give me a... How many people did you see lying injured on the floor trying to manage?
About 7-8.
And they were seriously injured?
Seriously injured.
The driver of the van was arrested. A U.S. warplane has shot down a Russian-made Syrian army jet, which Washington said dropped bombs near U.S.-backed forces. And Damascus says the plane was down while flying a mission against the Islamic State. Syrian analyst David Lesh of Trinity University says he's not surprised given the close proximity of the forces fighting to defeat IS.
You don't know if this is just a product of the Islamic State shrinking and forces getting in closer proximity to one another, or is this one side or the other taking it up a notch in terms of trying to stake out their territory and inevitably coming into conflict with other parties in the conflict zone.
Syria called it a flagrant attack. Yemeni medical officials in rebel-held northern Sana'a province claim that at least 25 people were killed when an aircraft in the Saudi-led coalition struck a market. There was no immediate claim or response for that coalition. The strike could not be independently confirmed. This is VOA News. U.S. Navy has confirmed all seven sailors missing on the USS Fitzgerald were found dead. They were in a flooded berthing compartment about after a collision with a Philippine flag container ship, all of that happening off the coast of Japan. Vice Admiral Joseph Okoin is commander of the U.S. 7th Fleet that's based in Tokyo.
The damage is mostly underneath the waterline, and it's a large gash near the keel of the ship. And so the water flow was tremendous. There wasn't a lot of time in those spaces that were open to the sea. And as you can see now, the ship is still listing. And so they had to fight the ship to keep it above the surface.
Cause of the early Saturday fatal mishap is under investigation. A massive forest fire in central Portugal has killed at least 61 people, many of them burned to death in their cars. At least 59 others reported to have been injured in the fire that erupted amid an intense heat wave there, rainless thunderstorms. Prime Minister Antonio Costa declared 3 days of national mourning. French President Emmanuel Macron appears to have won a commanding majority in the French Parliament following Sunday's second round of elections. Projections give Mr. Macron's Republic on the Move party and its allies up to 365 of the National Assembly's 577 seats. Analyst Natalie Doyle of Australia's Monash University speaks with VOA about Macron's plans for what to do with his parliamentary majority.
The ones that he will pass easily are the reforms to French labor law and the pension system. It looks like he will be able to do that easily with the majority that he has. In terms of his commitment to the European project, yes, he's very firmly committed to it, and in a sense so is French society, but a significant part of French society also would like France to become a little bit more French again, because it's been very German in recent times.
Voter turnout very low on Sunday, just over 40%. Climate change, trade, and terrorism were highlighted today at the Beijing meeting of the foreign affairs officials from Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, known collectively as the BRICS nations. They're hoping to further align their views on key issues at a time when President Trump is withdrawing the U.S. from multilateral agreements such as the Paris Climate Accords and the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union calls for calm in the border dispute between Djibouti and Eritrea.
I think what's important to highlight here is that the AU Commission is in close consultations with the authorities both in Djibouti and Eritrea, and is in the process of deploying a fact-finding mission to the Djibouti-Eritrea border.
Eba Kalando is spokesperson for the African Union Commission. Amnesty International calls on donor countries to fulfill their obligation by supporting Uganda in caring for South Sudan refugees. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame visits Zambia today, Monday, and Angola's parliament will this week debate a bill that gives President Dos Santos absolute immunity from any prosecution.
The project of law gives the president a so-called status of emeritus president and gives us also absolute immunity for himself and his deputy.
Mario Pavai is a veteran Angolan journalist. Norway helps develop local capacities to preserve Liberia's rainforests. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union is calling for calm in the border dispute between Djibouti and Eritrea. This comes after Djibouti last Friday blamed Eritrea for occupying a contested border region following the departure of Qatari peacekeepers last week. Qatar pulled its troops out after Djibouti and Eritrea sided with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states in a diplomatic row with Qatar. Eba Kalando, spokesperson for the African Union Commission, says the AU is sending a fact-finding mission to the disputed border area. She also says the African Union has offered to help Djibouti and Eritrea normalize their relations.
Following the recent events between the Republic of Djibouti and the state of Eritrea, after Qatar's decision to withdraw its peacekeeping troops at the Djibouti-Eritrea border, the chairperson of the African Union Commission, Mr. Moussa Faki Mahamat, is appealing for calm, restraint, and stresses that the EU is fully seized to the matter. I think what's important to highlight here is that the AU Commission is in close consultations with the authorities both in Djibouti and Eritrea and is in the process of deploying a fact-finding mission to the Djibouti-Eritrea border. The chairperson of the AU Commission also stands ready, of course, to assist Djibouti and Eritrea to normalize their relations and promote good neighborliness within the frameworks of the relevant and current AU instruments.
Do we know when the fact-finding mission will be undertaken? When will it take place?
Consultations are currently underway with authorities in both Djibouti and Eritrea, and that is part of the process of deploying the fact-finding mission to the Djibouti-Eritrea border. That will be done in consultation with and in agreement of the two parties involved, of course.
How did the AU come to reach the decision? Did they have a meeting with the two parties, the two countries?
We're in consultation with both countries after the Qatar's decision to withdraw its peacekeeping troops at the Djibouti-Eritrea border.
I mean, you are sending the peace mission, but what would this entail? How do you bring them together? This conflict has been going on like that.
I think we need to be clear with one thing. This is not a peace mission. There are consultations currently underway to deploy a fact-finding mission to the Djibouti-Eritrea border after the decision of Qatar to withdraw its peacekeeping troops from that Djibouti-Eritrea border. And this is in line, of course, with AU instruments and also to make sure that the Commission supports the member states, both Djibouti and Eritrea, to normalize their relationships and promote the good neighborliness within the frameworks of AU instruments that are currently in existence.
Eba, I do appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Eba Kalando is the spokesperson for the African Union Commission chairperson, Moussa Faki Mahamat. She was speaking with me from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Rwandan President Paul Kagame arrives in Zambia today, Monday, at the start of a two-day official visit at the invitation of Zambian President Edgar Lungu. Zambia presidential spokesman Amos Chanda says the two leaders will discuss ways to strengthen their bilateral relations, including the promotion of trade. He says they will also discuss regional issues, including Rwanda refugees in Zambia, now that Rwanda is stabilized from its 1994 conflict.
The purpose of the visit is essentially to discuss bilateral issues of concern between the two countries, how they can expand bilateral trade between Rwanda and Zambia. Zambia does produce sugar and cement, which are major exports to East Africa, including Rwanda. And also there's an airline that has been operating recently. Rwanda Airlines operates flights every day in the evening. So the idea is to increase bilateral cooperation, especially in terms of economic cooperation. The president of Rwanda will be visiting Zambia's biggest steel factory, Kafue Steel, and the idea is that Rwanda intends to press orders to import steel from Zambia. The two presidents understand that economic integration entails a stronger bilateral cooperation between and among African countries. The president of Zambia will be encouraging the president of Rwanda, among other things, to push on with the reforms of the African Union, which President Kagame was appointed chairperson for the reform process going on, so that apart from political reforms, the continent can push the agenda of intra-Africa trade, and particularly between the two countries.
Are they expected to discuss any regional issues?
Yes, they will. For instance, regional security and stability. We do have quite a good number of refugees from Rwanda who ran away from the 1994 genocide. Rwanda has since stabilized and have requested that those of their citizens who wish to return to Rwanda, they can do so. So there will be some time dedicated to discussing the status of those refugees, because under the international refugee arrangements under the UNHCR, United Nations High Commission for Refugees, clause of cessation, Rwanda basically cannot be said to be a country that can have refugees in another country, because it has been judged to have returned to stability.
Amos, how true is it, because there's some information on social media that perhaps your government is considering banning the Catholic Church or any church group in Zambia? Of course, this news is coming on the heels of the Council of Churches and the Conference of Catholic Bishops calling for the release of opposition leader Hakainde.
That is a lot of rubbish from those people who are in the habit of fomenting tensions between the government of the Republic of Zambia and the church. The democratic space available to the church as an independent institution and as a watchdog is beyond reproach. The Zambian government has never entertained that idea. The democratic space available in Zambia is that however critical the church can be, however critical the newspapers can be, that is the price of democracy, and there is no such idea whatsoever.
Amos Chanda is spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Amnesty International is accusing rich countries of failing to help Uganda support nearly a million South Sudan refugees in Uganda. In a report released today, Monday, Amnesty calls on donors, including the United States, European Union countries, Canada, China, and Japan, to step up their support for Uganda by providing timely funding for Uganda. The report comes ahead of a two-day high-level solidarity summit on refugees to be held in Uganda beginning this Friday. Audrey Godwin, Senior Director for Research for Amnesty International, says Amnesty is also calling on parties to the conflict in South Sudan and their international community to cease and prevent all abuses and violations, to support efforts for justice and reparations for victims.
We had researchers who visited the refugee settlements in Uganda and saw the situation there, talked to refugees, non-government organizations, the government of Uganda. And it's clear that Uganda needs more financial and technical support. And we're seeing that donors are just simply not coming, stepping up to the plate and giving the money that's been requested by Uganda and the United Nations. And what we're calling on donors to do is to really support Uganda in its efforts to support the refugees who are coming in from South Sudan, and who've obviously been through horrific situations in South Sudan.
These donors you're talking about, did they pledge this support already, or Uganda is making this appeal and the donors are not forthcoming?
Uganda and the United Nations have made appeals, and donors have not pledged anywhere near enough money to support Uganda. And as our report shows, Uganda is trying to do its best to support the refugees. It's the donors who are not supporting Uganda. And what we want is donors to really put their money on the table to support South Sudanese refugees, but to support Uganda, to support them.
You mentioned, Audrey, that some of your researchers have gone to Uganda to the settlement camps. What's the situation and how much is Uganda requesting in order to be able to deal with the situation there?
Well, the situation on the ground in Uganda is that there are so many refugees coming in who need support. Many of them are highly vulnerable and have been through very, very difficult situations in South Sudan and trying to leave South Sudan. When they get to Uganda, Uganda has a good model for supporting refugees, but at the moment there's not enough money behind the model. So what refugees are supposed to get, the basic support they're supposed to get, they're not getting. And the support for things like healthcare, education, psychosocial support for people who've been through significant trauma, this is not being prioritized by the donors. The donors are funding immediate relief, but not looking at the fact that many people, many refugees, have longer-term needs.
Audrey, I'm sure Amnesty is aware of what is called the donor fatigue, because it can be argued that the warring parties in South Sudan are making it difficult or are causing this donor fatigue, if at all there's any?
Well, in relation to donor fatigue, I'd have to say Amnesty International is sharply and strongly critical of the fatigue of donors or the failure of donors. Because you see donor countries leaving countries like Kenya, like Uganda, like Lebanon and Jordan in the Middle East to support very large refugee populations. And the donors are not coming in and supporting those countries who are already themselves doing such a lot. And this is creating enormous problems. So these donor countries are not letting the refugees into their own countries, and they're not providing support to those countries like Uganda that are trying to do their very best by refugees.
So is there anything, any message also that you may have for the parties in South Sudan who are involved in this conflict that is causing the refugees to flee to Uganda?
Obviously, Amnesty International calls on all parties to immediately cease all human rights violations, and we have documented very serious human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law by all parties in South Sudan. So the situation there is horrific. What we really want to see now is the refugees who are able to get to Uganda, that they do get the immediate support that they need, but also the longer-term support and support for those who are highly vulnerable.
Audrey Gargrind is the Senior Director for Research for Amnesty International. She was speaking with me from London, the United Kingdom. Today is Monday, June 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. This Thursday, Angola Parliament, dominated by the ruling Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA Party, will debate a bill that some say gives President José Eduardo dos Santos and his vice president absolute immunity from any prosecution for either economic or political crimes that they may have committed. President dos Santos, in power for 38 years, has decided not to seek another term in the August 2017 election. The bill also promises to pay the president a pension that is almost 90% of his current monthly salary of $6,200. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai says opposition politicians and civil society groups and even some in the ruling MPLA party are criticizing the bill, but he says the bill is expected to pass because the MPLA controls the majority of seats in parliament.
This project raises a lot of criticism, not only in the opposition parties, of course, but also inside the ruling party. We know that Irene Neto, a member of parliament, the MPLA, the ruling party, raised the criticism on the project, saying that these privileges are too much, and even his family, which means the family of the former and the first president of the Republic of Angola, Mr. Agostinho Neto, doesn't have this kind of privilege. The project of law gives the president a so-called status of emeritus president and gives also absolute immunity for himself and his deputy.
Mario, okay. According to this bill, the president is supposed to get a pension that is almost the same as his salary.
Yes, 90% of the current salary. But a part of the financial and the material privilege, which include diplomatic passports, cars and security corps and so and so. One of the questions which is, has been most criticized is, first, the so-called status of a married president, the status that even the first Angolan president, the late Agostinho Neto, doesn't have, and also the absolute impunity for all life. So it means that Mr. Dos Santos and his deputy, Mr. Manuel Vicente, couldn't go to court or couldn't be have something on law in all life. So nobody can criticize, nobody can ask him to go to court. That's one thing that's arising a lot of concern and the critics right now in Angola.
Mario, in a sense, don't you think the immunity is good? Because some people say if you don't do that, these African leaders will continue to remain in power until they die. So maybe they are trying to appease President Dos Santos so that he can leave.
What it does mean? For instance, the next president, which could be if the MPLA win the elections, the candidate, Mr. João Lourenço, himself and his family will also ask for the same statute, of course. And the things will go on forever. So this is just an excuse for the last leaders to avoid criticism from people and also to block changes in political system. This is not a solution. So I think there is a need to find maybe a balance of the solutions for society and people criticize and see the past and correct what is going wrong. Because there are a lot of violation of human rights, which has not been discussing and which some of them never go to trial. There are a number of solutions. For instance, the huge wealth that these presidents, their family, and all the inner circle of the ruling party accumulate during, in the case of Angola, 40 years, there must be a solution for these people to give back at least part of this huge wealth.
This bill, as I read it, is coming up for debate on Thursday. What are the chances that this bill will pass in Parliament?
This bill will pass, of course, because, as you know, the MPLA have got the majorities of MPs. Maybe some changes will be included. I'm not sure, for instance, if the so-called state of emeritus president, which is also raising a lot of questions, will be approved. Maybe it could be changes, but essentially the law will pass.
Mario Alpaivai is a veteran Angolan journalist. He was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. More than 40% of West Africa's rainforests are in Liberia, and that is part of the reason Norway has developed a $150 million partnership with Liberia to help the country fight deforestation. Oris Kesmo is the Norway government's point person to work with the Liberian authorities. He says they are hoping to develop local capacities within community forest groups that can then decide how they want to conserve or commercialize the forest.
And the government of Liberia has been working on the issue for several years, trying to get the commitment by the government that we try to follow up on now. We committed to help them mainly financially, but it's still in a very early phase. So project has been developed and implementation has started, but it's not really much progress on the ground yet.
You mentioned that around 40% of Liberia's land surface is covered in forest. What kind of opportunities and challenges does this pose for a project like this?
The reason for engaging with Liberia and the forest sector is that the West African country that still has a substantial forest left. It's a sad reality that even though Liberia is a very small country, it has 40% also of the remaining West African rainforest. So the forest areas that remains in Liberia, it's really valuable from environmental perspective. It has a rich biodiversity, a lot of species that can be found only there. It's really important to protect it or at least manage it in a sustainable manner. Of course, there's huge challenges given Liberia's development ambitions. There's a lot of pressure on the forest, and we try to work with them to help them seize the opportunities in a long-term management rather than being forced to grab to the more short-term opportunities.
This deal was made in 2015 when the Ebola crisis was still going on. How did that impact the launch of this deal?
Yeah, clearly it held back the progress. There was questions whether we should actually go enter into the deal during that period, but we found it more appropriate to close the agreement that we had been working on and show our support that way. And then, but it clearly affected the progress in starting implementation.
You said that a lot of the money right now, a lot of the resources are going toward developing these community forestry groups. Can you tell me a little bit about what those are?
It's right, as you say, that a substantial part of the Liberian forest will be managed as a community forestry.
Aris Kesmo is the Norway government's point person working with Liberian authorities to fight deforestation in Liberia. He was speaking to Ricky Shrike from Oslo. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the FIFA 2017 Confederations Cup holding in Russia, where African champions and representative, the Indomitable Lions of Cameroon, began the competition on a rather disappointing note as they lost 2-0 to South American champion Chile in the opening game of Group B. Arturo Vidal and Eduardo Vargas scored late on as Chile beat Cameroon in a game marred by another controversy surrounding the video assistant referee. Reigning World Cup winners Germany and Australia make up Group B and they go head-to-head later today. And back to Cote d'Ivoire, where Cheick Tiote was laid to rest in the Ivory Coast on Sunday following his sudden death in China earlier this month. The former Newcastle midfielder Tiote moved to China in February to play for second division side Beijing Enterprises and was training with his club when he collapsed and passed away after emergency treatment at the age of 30. Tiote, a 52-time capped Ivory Coast international who featured at the 2010 and 2014 World Cups, was honored with a military funeral at the Williamsville Cemetery in Abidjan, where hundreds of people gathered to mourn him, including members of the Ivory Coast national team. Kenya has been given an August deadline by CAF to be ready for the CHAN 2018 tournament or see the continental event get a new host. However, the delegation led by CAF Vice President Constant Selemani brushed aside concerns that the 16-team championship reserved for players who are playing in their domestic leagues might be moved to another country, saying Kenya should be able to deliver on its promises. Cabinet Secretary for Sport Hassan Wariro pledged to make sure Kenya is ready. And now to the CAF Confederations Cup, where Rivers United of Nigeria must win in Port Harcourt on Tuesday when they play visiting KCCA of Uganda to revive their hopes in the CAF Confederations Cup. They are bottom of the standings in Group A with 3 points from as many matches and need to win in front of their home fans to revive their chances of reaching the knockout rounds of the competition. Rivers United lost 2-1 to the Ugandan champions in their first clash in Kampala and now face a tough battle on Tuesday as they aim to advance from the group stage of the competition. Ghana Black Stars captain Asamoah Gyan says he's concerned that Ghana Black Stars under his leadership and playing career may not win any silverware. It has been 35 years since Ghana won anything. Asamoah Gyan, who became the first Ghanaian to score 50 goals for the Black Stars last Sunday, now features for Al Ain's bitter rivals Al Hilal on loan from Chinese giants Shanghai SIPG. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, June 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strike, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a preview of the Kenyan presidential election. The race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga. The main opposition candidate is looking increasingly competitive. a discussion on Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.